Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. This latest Wall Street story is ready-made for the big screen. Raj Rajaratnam, chief of the once $7 billion hedge fund Galleon, caught at the center of a powerful network of insider sources, and his former colleague, the man they call Octopussy, ensnared in his own tentacles. This hour On Point, two big insider trading busts and what they tell us about the world of finance and what they mean for the rest of us. You can join the conversation. What have you made of the Galleon and Octopussy cases? Do these scandals make you feel like the markets are rigged against you? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York City is Gregory Zuckerman, senior writer and columnist for The Wall Street Journal, who's been closely following the insider trading cases in the news. His new book out this month is The Greatest Trade Ever, the behind-the-scenes story of how John Paulson defied Wall Street and made financial history. Gregory, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Great to be here.
So take us inside Galleon and its founder, Raj Rajaratnam. Authorities say he masterminded one of the biggest insider trading schemes in a generation. Who is this guy?
So Raj is an interesting hedge fund trader, manages one of the bigger hedge funds, or he managed one of the bigger hedge funds in the world, based in New York City. Native of Sri Lanka, came over here and started up, became a technology analyst, one of the experts on Wall Street, and then went on to start Galleon. Galleon for years had really good returns, and what they were known for was sort of fast trading. In other words, not a Warren Buffett style, buy a stock and hold it forever, but focusing on a group of technology and often healthcare stocks and lots of trading in and out of them, and they try to get an edge. That was the big emphasis. All day long, he would tell his employees, his analysts, his traders, we need an edge here. And now the authorities are alleging that that edge was improper.
So, Raj, Forbes estimated his worth at, what, $1.3 billion recently, one of the richest people in the world, one of New York's financial elite, heading this this fund. We've heard a lot about the quant hedge funds, where these former physics majors sit around crunching numbers, making big trades. You described this fund as very different. How large was it at its peak?
At its peak, it was about $7 billion or so, and it was interesting firm because it had great returns, but it was a little bit below the radar screen, not on sort of the Greenwich or charity circuit, and wasn't in the same breath as some others, but people in the know realized they had really good returns, and now the question is how and why.
And what's the answer to that?
Well, that's what we're determining. I mean, there is a gray line here when it comes to getting an edge. There are people up and down Wall Street. That's their job all day long. They call companies. They call contacts. They call people who in turn know information, and they try to divine the next quarter's earnings. They try to figure out, anticipate the next acquisition. There are proper ways to do it and obviously improper ways, and that's what the government is alleging here, that they went over the line and they actually got tip-offs as to things like acquisitions and other earnings such that their profits were improper.
Prosecutors are looking into a network of conspirators with elements of really a James Bond movie here. Who were the sources involved in all this?
Yeah, it's expanding, this investigation, and it continues to expand. So just a few days ago, someone was arrested, Zvi Goffer, and he had spent some time at Galleon. He was at another hedge fund.
This is the guy known as Octopussy, right?
He is Octopussy because he had his hands in so many places. He had so much information coming to him. It was law firms. He had people at law firms working on acquisition deals, tipping off people who in turn tipped him off. And allegedly, he was doing pretty well making these trades.
And at one point I'm reading he worked for Galleon for 8 months. Is that right?
Yes. There are these groups of traders on Wall Street that strike out and they join firms and they get some capital. They get some cash from these firms, and Galleon was among them. Schottenfeld was another. And there are a bunch of others up and down the street that they'll say, okay, you have a pretty good record. here's $10 million, here's $50 million, see what you can do with it. And if they do well, then they stay and they get a cut, they get a percentage of their gains. And if they don't do well, they're out of there. So there's a lot of pressure on these guys to produce. Mm.
There are some incredible stories about this fellow, Zvi Guffer, that you referred to. Apparently one point tearing up his SIM card on his cell phone, breaking it with his teeth, worrying that somebody's going to go to jail here, make sure it's not you.
Yeah, that doesn't sound too good, right?
Yeah.
That sounds a little self-incriminating when you're doing that kind of stuff. Right. There are arguments up and down the street that, well, there's a gray area here and you don't want to go over the line, but a lot of us do it properly. But when you're caught doing those kinds of things, it doesn't look good.
So people ensnared in this are big fish. Isn't that right, Gregory Zuckerman? I mean, director from McKinsey, vice president of IBM, senior exec at Intel, and the list goes on.
You know, that's what's remarkable about this case. There have been insider trading cases here and there over the years, ever since the big, obviously, Milken and Boske cases. But this is the first that's ensnared big names. Raj at Galleon is among the top hedge fund traders in the world. But as you mentioned, I'm as taken by the executive ensnared. The IBM executive, some people had predicted, might run the company someday. So for him to get involved is quite shocking. And the McKinsey former chief, these are big honchos in the executive ranks as well as on Wall Street.
And how many people have pleaded guilty? How many people have denied the charges?
It's just been a handful so far that pleaded guilty. And there are going to be some interesting cases. Again, they're going to, people like Raj will argue that, hey, all, and this is what I've talked to people that are close to him and I've been covering this, and he argues, all day long, people are calling me up with information. Some of it's good, some of it's bad, some I listen to, some I don't listen to. Sure, maybe these people who've pleaded guilty have contacted me and gave me some information, but I didn't necessarily use it.
And so what kind of payments are we talking about? What kind of payments, if any, did these executives get for giving up this insider information?
Some of it was not that much, you could argue, $10,000 at times. Other people just were allowed to invest with some of these hedge fund managers. It's not a dramatic amount of money to compromise your career, especially if you're somebody who might go on to run IBM. It's quite startling. Mm.
What was so interesting to me is if Raj Rajaratnam was trading on insider information in this huge trading scheme, he apparently was not very good at it at times. I mean, in many trades, he lost money, did he not? He made bad bets.
Yeah, that's also a little bit of spin on the part of Raj's camp, though, to tell you the truth. They're arguing that if you isolate some of these trades in which he allegedly got inside information, he didn't do so well, but I'm not sure if you add them all up that he lost money on them. And that said, if you cheat and turns out that the market collapses such that your picks don't do so well, it's still cheating. Again, this is all alleged. We'll see what happens. Mm-hmm. But I'm not that sympathetic to that argument.
Can you describe the culture at Galleon, the culture that was headed by Raj Rajaratnam?
Yeah, it was a unique place in that everyone needed to find information. That was the goal. Every analyst, every trader, they had to get an edge. And it wasn't really defined within the firm. We've written about this a little bit, and it's a fascinating place, but sometimes you follow the leader. And Raj was really good at anticipating earnings and getting acquisitions right. And I think the assumption among some people I've talked to within the firm was, by any means necessary, you need to get this information. That's not to say that they necessarily all crossed the line, but there was pressure to figure out what the next earnings and the next acquisition would be, which is quite difficult, as we all know. And I've talked to some analysts who say, well, analysts are these people that work within the firm and try to figure these things out. And they say, I was never specifically told, get inside information, but we felt all kinds of pressure to come up with some kind of edge.
I'm looking at a flowchart, all the tentacles reaching from Raj Rajaratnam.
It's remarkable, yeah.
It is remarkable, and I find it curious, if not impossible, to think that others did not know about this, did not know that this was going on, this multi-billion-dollar scheme.
Yes, one could, by looking at those charts, come to that conclusion that also one could conclude that you would have thought it would have come out at this point, given so many people involved. Somebody is bound to get caught and talk to the authorities or go to the authorities. You can make that argument that it's widespread and that it raises all kinds of questions about Wall Street and how things go, how people are operating within the hedge fund world. You could also make the counter argument that these are a few bad apples and maybe it doesn't spoil the whole bunch.
How was he caught? This was not the first time Raj Rajaratnam had been in trouble before, but how was he caught this time?
He had been, as you mentioned, here and there caught, but it sounds like they used wires, which is unique. The FBI is involved, and that's unique. The SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, has received ample criticism in the last few years for missing all kinds of scandals, of course, the Bernie Madoff scandal. But it's interesting that the FBI is involved here, and they've got capabilities that the SEC doesn't have, including wiretaps. So that seems to have helped the effort.
Why should the average investor, Gregory Zuckerman, or the average person think this story to be interesting or even care about it? I mean, why is this so important to our economy, to people generally?
Well, to me, it's quite startling how senior these executives are, both Raj, the IBM executive, the McKinsey, as we talked about, and the possibility that it could spread, which raises all kinds of questions about the markets, who has information, should I as an individual investor be worried when I'm selling my, 100 shares of Dell computer that the guy on the other side buying it from me has some inside information. And there's a group of people out there, conservatives mostly, who say that's okay. Inside information and even on trading on inside information actually makes the market more efficient. It's an interesting argument. I would counter that by saying that if you raise questions about markets, you're going to scare away all kinds of investors, and that can't be good for the country.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about a big crackdown on insider trading in this country. Preet Bharara is U.S. attorney for the New York Southern District, and here he is in a November 5th news conference taped by CNBC. He's explaining why cracking down on insider trading is so important.
The casual betrayal of corporate secrets by insiders threatens the integrity of our markets and victimizes the companies they owed a duty to honestly represent. It makes a mockery of our system.
That's U.S. Attorney for New York Southern District. With me this hour, Gregory Zuckerman, senior writer and columnist for The Wall Street Journal. His new book out this month is The Greatest Trade Ever, the behind-the-scenes story of how John Paulson defied Wall Street and made financial history. And joining me now from Philadelphia is Arthur Laby, professor of law at Rutgers School of Law in Camden, New Jersey. Before joining Rutgers, he served nearly 10 years on the staff of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Professor, nice to have you with us. Thank you.
Hi, happy to be here.
Give us the definition, if you would, of insider information.
Insider information is just non-public information, like news of an upcoming merger or news of an earnings report that is not yet public. But the harder question, Jane, I think, is what is insider trading? And there, not all trading on inside information is illegal. It's only illegal if the trader has a duty not to trade. So, for example, if you overhear people talking on a crowded subway about an upcoming deal, you can trade on that information even if you know the information is not public. But if you work at the company, or if you are the company's lawyer or investment banker, that's different because then you have a duty not to trade.
And often insider trading happens by outsiders, not insiders. And Raj Rajaratnam, this fellow that we've been talking about who masterminded one of the biggest insider trading schemes in a long time, was an outsider, wasn't he?
Right. So Raj apparently was an outsider. And outsiders are people who gather information from insiders but who are not insiders themselves. And there the law is a little bit less clear. So if an insider trades on non-public information, it's easy to prove that they're liable because they have a built-in duty not to trade. But if an outsider like Raj trades, then the government has a big hurdle. It's got to prove that he got the information from an insider and he knew that he got the information from an insider who had a duty not to divulge the information. That's a more difficult hurdle. Hmm.
Let's listen again to this press conference on November 5th. This is Preet Bharara, U.S. Attorney for New York Southern District. He is saying his investigation of this case goes well beyond hedge funds.
It would be a mistake to think that this investigation is focused only or even principally on hedge funds. We have gone far beyond that. In fact, this investigation goes to the very heart of fair play in the business world. We're not just talking about aggressive hedge fund traders who were trying to get an edge. Someone had to give them that illegal edge. It takes two to tango.
What's the reaction generally to this investigation, Professor, would you say, in the hedge fund world and beyond?
Well, I think it's clear that the SEC is sending a message that both the commission and the criminal authorities are getting tough on the regulation of the securities markets overall. I mean, these insider trading cases, they have great symbolic power. They send a message out to the public. Insider trading is a crime that everyone loves to hate. People understand it. And the regulators, I think, are sending a message. They may have missed the Bernie Madoff scandal, but they are now being quite vigilant in the regulation of the markets.
Who's responsible for policing insider trading? Is it the SEC? Is the FBI? Attorney generals? Who is it?
Well, that's very interesting. It's actually both. So the securities laws are both criminal laws and non-criminal laws. So the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, enforces the insider trading laws, but the SEC is not a criminal authority. They cannot send people to jail. The Department of Justice also enforces the insider trading laws, and of course, they can send people to jail. So it's both the SEC and the Department of Justice who are on the beat.
Let's bring some of our listeners into this to get their perspective. Max is on the line from Des Moines, Iowa. Max, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi, Gene.
Hi.
Yes, when people buy and sell in the market, it's a zero-sum game. If one person gains more, the other person gains less. I think a lot of people, say in the Martha Stewart scandal, mm-hmm. didn't seem to understand that. Maybe the public needs to be educated that her getting more means there's less available for everybody else. And I'm wondering, I have all my money in the Vanguard Fund, just an ordinary investor, and I'm kind of wondering how much impact all this is having on my return when these people become billionaires, and there I sit, you know, with my piddly little whatever I get.
I hear you, Max. It's a great question. Gregory Zuckerman, will you answer it? How much of this impacts the ordinary investor?
Well, we'll see how this investigation goes and how widespread this alleged improper trading is. I would argue that it's improper at the margins, so it doesn't affect the entire market, but we'll see if it gets extended. I mean, hedge funds have a real incentive to cheat, I would argue, in that they get paid much more than anybody else. They have a great structure, in they get a big chunk of everything that they make. I don't think they're any worse than anybody else in terms of morals. They just have a little bit more of incentive.
But how much pressure to get financial returns is there, especially given the financial meltdown? You talk about this incentive to cheat. The game has changed, hasn't it, somewhat, Professor Levy?
It has. The pressure on hedge funds is just enormous to eke out just a slightly higher return to beat out that next hedge fund down the street. But again, that doesn't mean that all gathering of information is necessarily illegal. So in the case of Galleon, again, the government's going to have to show that the hedge fund received information from someone who had a duty not to divulge it, and Galleon knew that. Because gathering information in and of itself is what hedge funds do every day of the week. That's their job.
And Professor Leiby, to Max's point, to the caller's point, what's the impact on the rest of us here? It's easy to feel that the market is rigged against you when you hear stories such as we're talking about today.
Well, that's a very important point because, as Gregory mentioned earlier, there are some strong arguments and many people believe that, in fact, we should allow insider trading because it's somewhat of a victimless crime. And one of those arguments is that when somebody buys or sells in the market, they're not really being induced to do that by the insider trader. It's not as if they've decided to sell or buy because the insider is buying or selling. They would have sold or bought anyway. But the point, I think, is the perception of unfairness that exists among the rest of us when insiders are buying and selling using information that we can never get access to.
Here's another call from Stowe, Vermont. David has been waiting. Welcome to On Point. David, hello.
Hi. Yeah. Well, first I'd like to say to Gregory Zuckerman, $10,000 is a lot of money. I don't know, you know, maybe on Wall Street it isn't, but it's, to the rest of us it is.
To me as well.
The point that the Galleon case represents is that it is the antithesis of meritocracy. And this is typical of all these cases. And it's ultimately the distortion of Wall Street. The financial markets have become a means in and of themselves as opposed to providing liquidity for companies who are actually doing something. Mm. It's just, and I contrast their behavior with that of Warren Buffett, who just recently bought Burlington Northern Santa Fe. And I think you would be hard-pressed to have made any significant amount of money, even if you knew Warren Buffett was going to buy Burlington Northern, because the point is he bought that for a long-term investment because he knows they have a good market and it's a well-run company. And so these guys, they're cheating. And the fact is that, the professor is saying, well, is this a victimless crime or whatever? Rumi Khan was an employee of Intel. And I can tell you that, in most companies, you are not allowed to give out information. And she was paid to give out that information.
All right, so, David, thank you. I'll let the professor respond. Professor Leiby?
Well, that's absolutely right. If the insider gets a check, that's fairly strong circumstantial evidence that the insider had a duty not to disclose because the money is an inducement to divulge information that he or she should not be sharing. And, of course, the check is good evidence that the person paying knows that the insider had a duty not to divulge the information. So I'm not suggesting for a minute that that kind of conduct is appropriate. And, in fact, that sort of conduct may show the duty that I mentioned earlier. That's exactly what the government will need to prove.
Gregory Zuckerman, how difficult is it to prosecute these cases with so many links in the information chain?
Well, the professor's more of an expert. I would argue that it is quite difficult. There are gray areas. That said, if you read some of the complaint and what these people did to try to avoid being caught, and they seem to say a lot of self-incriminating things. They seem to have been aware that what they were doing was improper. So I don't know how you're going to get around that as a defense attorney.
Professor Leiby, the difficulty in prosecuting these kinds of cases?
Yeah, the difficulty goes back to the duty element that I mentioned earlier. And in these insider trading cases, particularly when you've got one person tipping another, who's tipping a third, who's tipping a fourth, the SEC or the Department of Justice must establish each link in the chain. And if one of the links is broken, that is to say, if the defense attorneys can prove that there was not a duty to keep the information non-public, or if there was, or if the trader did not know of that duty, if they can break a link, then the government has a much more difficult burden and often cannot proceed.
Here's another call from Lansing, Michigan. Lenore is on the line. Lenore, welcome to One Point. Hello to you.
Hi.
Hello.
I just had a comment. Mm-hmm. Years ago, I had to trace wealth for a part of my job. And there were a couple of things. One is that hedge funds seem to be beyond all public filings, and so there was very little regulation of them. So that's something that the country needs to address. But beyond that, in terms of insider trading, there were filings through the Edgar system, the public filings, that made it clear that insiders were selling their holdings. Mm. And this came up, I forgot there was a case during the Bush administration. And it was very obvious to anybody who had to check the filings, which would be any government employee within the SEC should have known it. The fact that they had an elephant in front of them and weren't looking at the elephant is the problem when it comes to that, because the information is there.
Mm. Lenore, thank you.
If I could answer that one.
Yes, please, Gregory.
It's actually something of a myth that hedge funds don't get any scrutiny and they don't give out any information. They give out much less than, say, a mutual fund, but they do file every quarter their top holdings. Many of them are registered with the SEC voluntarily. They get audited by the SEC. Now, one could clearly argue that they don't get enough scrutiny, for sure, but the bulk of them, I think, do their job properly. And let's face it, their clients are endowments, charities, pension funds. So while not to say that a few of them don't cheat, the bulk of the industry does its job much better than the mutual fund industry, I would argue.
Professor Leiby, help me understand that point, because as I understand it, I'm hearing Gregory Zuckerman say these hedge funds register every quarter, but I understood the government is pushing to have hedge funds register, generally speaking. Is that right? Or put that into perspective for me.
That's right. What Gregory was talking about are certain filings that all money managers must file if they have a certain amount of money under management. But and that's true. They do have to make certain filings with the SEC. But you're also correct that there is a very big debate right now on Capitol Hill with respect to whether to require the advisors to the hedge funds, that is, shops like Raj operated, to register with the SEC as investment advisors. So you have to distinguish the fund on the one hand, which is just a pool of money, from the advisor, the firms that run these hedge funds, on the other. And right now, there is an exemption on the books for hedge fund advisors. They are not required to register with the SEC. Many, in fact, have gone ahead and done that on a voluntary basis. The SEC tried to have all hedge fund advisors register and failed in their attempt to do so a few years back. But many register anyway. And in those cases, those advisors are audited on an ongoing basis. The SEC can go in. They can do an inspection and an examination of the registered advisor. But most hedge fund advisors today are still not registered. And that's the battle on Capitol Hill. There is legislation afoot to require all hedge fund advisors, or most hedge fund advisors, to register with the SEC. Mm.
Good. Mark is calling now from Niagara Falls, New York. Mark, welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thank you. This is kind of a legal question. This has troubled me since, if you remember, Martha Stewart was an inside trader dealing in a company that had a drug company that had a drug in a pipeline.
ImClone. Yep.
That was very promising, and somebody within the Food and Drug Administration gave some officer of that company inside information that it wasn't going to be approved. Now, I would have thought that the Food and Drug Administration would have some kind of a legal responsibility not to tell anybody until they told everybody. It would be like if I had a company that was applying for a patent and the patent office told me before they told anybody else that my patent was denied, well, I'd dump all the stock.
So your point is it takes two to tango, Mark, and nobody at the FDA was ever named, Professor Leiby? What about that?
Well, the FDA may have certain non-public communications with companies, but that doesn't mean that the company can then go out and trade on that information. I mean, companies, of course, have confidential information about their own business all of the time. And there's certainly the law is quite clear that then the insiders at those companies, whether it's about a patent or whether it's about their own upcoming earnings or their recent discovery of a cure for some disease, that the individuals at that company, of course, cannot then go out and trade on that information. They have a duty to refrain from trading until the information is made public. That's the so-called disclose or abstain motto of insider trading. You either disclose it to the public or you refrain from trading.
Gregory Zuckerman, I'm just going to ask you flat out here, but we're talking about these two big cases of insider trading. But how widespread is this? Is trading on industry knowledge widespread? Is insider trading widespread? How would you define it?
Well, I think it's widespread to trade on information about companies. The question is whether it's improper information. All day long, traders, analysts at hedge funds, they look for the big trade. That's sort of what my book is about, a bunch of guys looking for the big trade, and it happens all day long. And usually you need to call around. You do these things called channel checks, and it means calling contacts within a company, contacts that know a company, contacts that have dealt with a company. So there is a push, an urgency to get this kind of really proprietary information. Whether people cross the line, Professor can probably address this, but it's interesting. If you call a company up and they kind of give you a sense for the quarter, but it's something maybe that they've said before publicly, that's all well and good and legal. But if they hint at a little bit more, then they've gone over the line. So there's a line there.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. You can join our conversation this hour about insider trading. Would the promise of a handsome payday make you cross the line and tip somebody off about your company? You can also follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On this point of insider trading, we look to the 1987 Oliver Stone film Wall Street. And here's Gordon Gekko, played by Michael Douglas, giving a speech on greed, very similar to a speech the insider trader Ivan Bosky gave at a commencement ceremony in 1986.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit.
We are speaking this hour with Gregory Zuckerman, senior writer and columnist for The Wall Street Journal. His new book out this month is The Greatest Trade Ever, the behind-the-scenes story of how John Paulson defied Wall Street and made financial history. Also with Arthur Leiby, professor of law at Rutgers School of Law in Camden, New Jersey. Before joining Rutgers, he served for nearly 10 years on the staff of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. And joining me now from New York, finance historian and professor of economics at New York University Stern School of Business is Richard Silla. His books include The American Capital Market and A History of Interest Rates. Professor Silla, nice to have you with us.
Hello.
Insider trading is nothing new, as you well know. Give us some examples here. Take us back in history. Give us some examples of some insider trading scandals from the past, from Alexander Hamilton to Ivan Bosky, Michael Milken, among others.
Well, you can go back even before Hamilton to England and the South Sea Bubble, all kinds of insiders, including the King of England, members of Parliament, even Sir Isaac Newton. He was an insider. They had advance word that the South Sea Company was going to bull up its stock price by a scheme to convert the British national debt into the stock of the company. The insiders bought their stock at low prices. They knew that they were going to make some speculative profits as the public learned about the scheme and a bubble occurred. So that's 1720. 70 years later, Alexander Hamilton was formulating his plans for the financial system of the U.S. While he was doing so in late 1789, he had an assistant at the Treasury Department, a man named William Duer, looking over his shoulder. And Duer said, gee, if Hamilton's plan goes through, the U.S. government bonds are going to be worth a lot more money. So Duer proceeded to go out and buy up a lot of bonds, and he and his friends did that. He sort of left the Treasury very quickly after that. Hamilton may have smelled a rat, but Duer nonetheless probably made a killing when the bonds, Hamilton's plans, were enacted and the bonds went up in price. And you go in the 19th century, you had people like Jay Gould, Daniel Drew, Jim Fisk manipulating railroads. They were the insiders of the railroads, and, you know, they printed stock, sold it, all kinds of, you know. So if we come up to the 1980s, the Bosky, Milken, others were finding out what was going to happen first. Bosky used to pay people to tell him when a merger was going to be announced before it was announced, and would take positions, try to make money that way. So I'd say insider trading is as old as the hills.
As old as the hills, and as you've studied it, at the core of this, is it just about pure greed, as we heard Michael Douglas from the movie clip? Is it getting around the law? I mean, what is it at the heart of this?
Well, I think insider trading really hasn't been all that illegal in this country before the 1930s. It was probably unethical, maybe a little immoral. But it wasn't illegal, and we decided in the 1930s that it ought to be illegal. And after that, then people who used to take advantage of the markets before the 30s, they became criminals after the 1930s. So, you know, our views on insider trading have changed over the centuries. I think some of the inside traders of the 18th and 19th centuries were admired for being clever and smart.
So is this modern-day story that we're speaking of today, Raj Rajaratnam, the head of Galleon, the two big insider trading schemes that we're discussing, Octopussy, are these modern-day Ivan Boskys? I mean, these stories hold true to what you've seen in history?
I think they fit the pattern pretty well. It appears that, Octopussy paid money, Rajaratnam paid money. These are allegations, of course. They need to be tried in a court of law, but It appears that they were paying people for inside information, and there was a rather large network involved in doing that, and, you know, people did make some money on it. But I would say there was nothing really new in it. It's just the latest example of something that's been going on for a long time, and both large scale. I think the thing about this case is it's larger in scale than some. Boesky's, of course, was fairly large scale as well. But there's a lot of minor instances of this, you know, kind of people we never heard of getting inside information, passing it on to friends and relatives. So, I mean, it's really, this fits the pattern. It's just a bigger case.
You mentioned the rules and laws changing in the 30s, but I'm curious, has the playing field ever been completely fair for the average investor playing against the resources of the high and mighty?
Well, I don't think it's totally fair. You know, some people, you know, is it, you know, some people who are not engaged in insider trading, some get information before the average person does, and that gives them a little bit of an advantage if the market moves. But that's not really insider trading. That's just being the first to get some important information and figuring out what it means. And I think you have to emphasize, too, that just having information isn't necessarily a good thing if you don't know how to interpret it. What's really bad about insider information is that they pretty much know what's going to happen when the information they have now gets released later and they take a large position. So it's, you know, it's a bit like shooting fish in a barrel.
How has the information age changed insider trading, Richard Sella, comparatively speaking, when information travels at the speed of light? How are things different now?
Well, I think there's some deals that, you know, information, of course, travels at the speed of light. When, they say, a proposed merger is announced, lately there's been one where Kraft has been trying to take over Cadbury, an English chocolate maker. When that deal is announced, of course, everyone knows it all around the world very quickly, particularly those sitting in front of screens. But suppose that somebody inside Kraft told you a month or two or three that Kraft was going to go after Cadbury, and nobody else in the world knew it. So it didn't matter how fast information can travel. What's important is that you know before anyone else that the deal is has a good chance of taking place or some sort of action will occur. Then you could load up with Cadbury stock knowing that Kraft would probably pay a premium.
I'm curious, over time, Richard Sella, what the government has done to discourage insider trading and what it should do, what it might do now.
Well, I think it's made it illegal. Of course, there are problems of always identifying, you know, what is the case of insider trading. But I think it's fairly clear now if you or your friends and relatives find out something from an insider before anyone else and you take a large position and make some money on that, I think the government says that's the definition of insider trading, and you can usually track it down. After all, we did catch Octopussy, and we did catch the hedge fund that was Galleon Hedge Fund that's been making these deals. And, you know, the trades they make leave a record, and so I think it's not all that difficult to sort out when it might have occurred, and then you have an investigation, and you find some confirmation that it occurred. So I think it's, you know, it's not all that difficult to detect.
Richard Sella, I appreciate your time today. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Richard Sella is joining us from New York City, finance historian and professor of economics at New York University's Stern School of Business. Let's go back to the phones. Attleboro, Massachusetts is where Jim is calling from. Jim, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to make the comment that, you know, people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. I mean, how many of us have gotten inside information on a job opportunity, or how many of us have cheated a little on our tax returns because our friends did and they told us it was okay? And, you know, I as much as I'd like to demonize these people, they're just doing what we do on a larger scale. And until we as a society stop, you know, not looking at money as idolizing it and, you know, telling our children they should marry doctors and lawyers and people who have money, until we stop doing that and stop looking at the qualities that really make our society great, which would be, you know, helping others and community and relationships, I think we're going to continue to go down this path. Thank you very much.
All right, Jim. Thank you. Thank you very much. Becky is now calling from New Ellington, South Carolina. Becky, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just want to point out that I started being employed back when they actually had pensions. And people somehow found ways to go about taking the money out of the pensions so the people that were saving didn't actually have money for old age. And then they started having 401ks.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had great suspicions about it from the beginning. Mm. And as history shows, people have always used insider trading. And what the gentleman just said before me, you know, that's great, but these people are actually taking from folks that are saving for their old age and don't have billions of dollars.
I hear it, Becky. It's a good point, this public suspicion of the markets. Gregory Zuckerman, will you speak to that in your reporting? Is that generally what you sense?
Yeah, although my concern is more whether it raises questions about the capital markets and it scares investors away. I'm not sure, as the professor said earlier, whether you can really pinpoint losses, deep losses on investors. And, you know, I find it interesting that investment bankers are not involved in this round of insider trading or alleged insider trading. In the Milken days, obviously, they were key to it all. And maybe it's one point we can take encouragement from, that we see some lawyers who are getting caught in this thing, hedge fund managers, and a lot of executives within companies. But at least these investment banker types maybe learned their lesson, hopefully. And the other point I was going to make is that greed is part of it, but it's fascinating to me what people do for a relatively small amount of money. Again, if you're making $500,000, a few million dollars a year, and you're getting paid $10,000 for a tip, it seems like it's as much trying to ingratiate yourself with someone else. And I think they play on that, the insider traders, as much as it is greed.
Let's go to Charles. He's calling from Boston. Charles, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hello. I had a comment for the gentleman who said that it was the trades on the inside were victimless. Can he explain to the audience how a naked short would operate at a hedge fund and what that does to actual holders of the stock when a hedge fund performs a naked short in mass on a firm that they have inside knowledge of? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right, Charles. Thank you.
It's Greg speaking,
yes,
I could
please.
Jump in. Naked shorting is not insider trading. It's improper. It's basically when you short sell, you sell short shares without actually being in control of them. And that the SEC has ruled is improper, and they're trying to crack down on that. And I think they should do more of that. But that's not insider trading.
Professor Labey, jump back in here. Arthur Labey, how does insider trading in the U.S. compare with other financial markets around the world?
Well, it's quite interesting. You can look back through history and see that different countries have come at their insider trading laws at different times. So, yes, we passed securities laws in the 1930s, but it actually wasn't until the 1960s that the SEC brought its first insider trading case, a case called Katie Roberts, and told the world, we now believe that insider trading is illegal fraud under the securities laws. And, of course, since that time, it's been bringing insider trading cases ever since. In some foreign countries, it took quite a long time. In Germany, the insider trading laws were not passed until the 1990s, and it's only recently that some other countries like the UK have really begun to crack down and bring enforcement cases in the insider trading area. And in still other countries, insider trading is not necessarily illegal.
Some argue that insider trading should be legal. Is that not right?
Right. That's correct. And the point I made earlier is when you step back, and by the way, the SEC staff in some interesting older speeches have acknowledged this, that when the insider decides today that he or she is going to buy or sell, the person on the other side of that trade would have traded anyway. It's not as if that person would decide not to trade, or somehow that the insider caused that person to trade or not to trade. So that's the point about a victimless crime. But there are other arguments as well, and I don't necessarily subscribe to these, but many academics argue that insider trading pushes stock prices in the right direction. So if we would have allowed insider trading during the Enron implosion, then maybe some employees who knew what was going on at Enron would have been selling their shares like crazy. That would have sent a message to the marketplace that something was afoot at Enron, and it actually would have saved a lot of investors from losing their shirts in cases like Enron and WorldCom, because there would have been fairly massive selling by insiders who knew what was happening.
Let me try to squeeze a last call in here. Ted is in Ferrisburg, Vermont. Ted, welcome. We don't have much time. If you could be brief, sir. Thank you.
Hello. I want to know if it's still insider trading, if it's done by software by trading companies looking at the very immediate future of trades their own potential customers are making. And then based on that microsecond of insider trading information, not a day, not something heard at the golf course, but a moment in time, Is that still fair? Can I still buy against that kind of inside information? And thanks.
Ted, thank you. Gregory Zuckerman?
I believe that's front-running. I don't think that's considered inside information. Professor?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and it gets to the sort of outer reaches of insider trading law. And again, you'd have to go back and really look carefully at what the program is intended to do, and if it's able to and intended to pick up information that's not yet public, and you know that information is not public, then the SEC could consider trying to bring a case, but I think it would be quite difficult if anybody could develop that program or buy that program and then trade on it.
Gregory Zuckerman, let me ask you in our final moments here, given these two big insider trading cases, do you foresee another big scandal in a few years, or is this crackdown a wake-up call?
I don't know about a few years, maybe a few weeks or a few days. I mean, the investigators have suggested that it's going to expand. And there are people up and down Wall Street that I speak with who are very nervous right now. They're checking their emails. Mm. It's not to say they did anything wrong, but they're worried that perhaps it'll look like that. So this will be an interesting story, ongoing one.
Really interesting story and a very interesting hour. I appreciate your perspectives, both of you. Gregory Zuckerman, senior writer, columnist for The Wall Street Journal, been closely following the insider trading cases in the news. His new book out this month is The Greatest Trade Ever, the behind-the-scenes story of how John Paulson defied Wall Street and made financial history. Gregory, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Professor Arthur Levy from Rutgers School of Law in Camden, New Jersey. Before joining Rutgers, he was on the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission for nearly 10 years. Thank you very much, Professor. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You can continue the conversation. Listeners, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for your calls. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.